Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the EG Property Podcast and the latest in our series looking at sustainability. And today we're going to be talking about the wonderful world of retrofitting and the challenges and the opportunities that come with that. And joining me in the podcast studio today is five guests, so it's a full house here today, which will be very interesting, lots of different voices. So just a quick hello from everyone. So I'm going to start, I was going to say on my left, but no one can see because it's a podcast. But on my left, starting with James Ford, who's partner at Hawley. James, tell us a little bit about you and Hawley and why you're here to talk to us about retrofitting.
Sure. Okay. So my role in Hawley is partner lead for the sustainability group. Within the company, we span pretty much all key sectors, and workplace has been one of those for many years. We have been on a journey with the UK Green Building Council in particular, with their defining net zero aim in that framework. And that one, I think, is probably partly the key reason why we're here, why I'm here today, to talk about that in the context of workplace.
Fantastic, thank you. And next to James is Brian Bickle, who is Chief Executive of Shaftesbury. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
And tell us a little bit about, without giving too much away early on, I suppose, why we've invited you into this studio to talk about retrofitting.
Well, I suppose Shaftesbury does have some experience of the challenges here, and we've own some 15 acres of the West End of London, but within that we've got 600 buildings, roughly 600, we can never quite count them and get to the same answer every time. The thing they all have in common is they're really quite old and quite small, so we reckon the average age is about 150 years or more. We've got some that goes to 250 years. Everything we own is in a conservation area. We think over 20% of our buildings are listed. So it's really quite challenging, but we've been used to addressing these challenges in our particular building stock, but it's very interesting to see the way the agenda for sustainability is growing and how much more we have to do than just simply beyond our own buildings, working with our neighbours and with similar sort of problems, and that's the way forward for everybody, I think.
Fantastic, thank you. And joining us back in the podcast studio is Chris Bennett from Evora. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Sam. Yeah, so I guess from our perspective of being sustainability consultants to around 60 investment managers in real estate, the sustainability agenda is constantly evolving. And now with so much focus on net zero, retrofit becomes incredibly important. So hopefully I can provide some examples and case studies of what some of our clients are doing and how this is evolving for us.
Fantastic, thank you. And also joining us back in the podcast studio is Sarah Ratcliffe, who's Chief Executive of the Better Buildings Partnership.
Morning, yeah. So Best Buildings Partnership is a collaboration of major property owners, currently 34 members with just over $250 billion worth of assets under management between them. And we work largely with them on their existing buildings, trying to understand the challenges that they face, what they can do, and what the advantages and what the benefits are of addressing sustainability across those assets.
Thank you. And last but by no means least is Karen Jamison, who is Head of Sustainability at Workspace Group. I can't speak, I apologise.
Good morning. So Workspace own, develop and manage 61 flexible office spaces in London. And our customers range from startups to established brands. And the majority of our portfolio are older historic buildings. Some of them are listed as well, just like Shaftesbury. And we've got a constant refurbishment or rolling refurbishment and redevelopment programme where we try and keep as much of the original building as possible. And so we're here to talk about retrofitting buildings as well.
Fantastic. So let's start with, I guess, the big question, which is why is retrofitting such an important part of the movement, I suppose, that we need to be fully involved with if we want to halt, slow, fix climate change? Sarah?
Well, I suppose the short answer to that is because our existing buildings weren't built with net zero in mind. and therefore there are lots of challenges with those existing buildings that we need to look at. I would say that there's a huge amount that can be done by actually just managing those buildings better. That will get us so far, but the reality is that if we're going to be able to reach those net zero targets by 2050, much of that existing building stock is going to be need to be retrofitted in some shape or form going forward.
And if you're a landlord like Shaftesbury, and the vast majority, if not all, of your portfolio is in need of that retrofitting, what do you look at your portfolio, Brian, and think, I don't know where to start? or what? How do you look at it?
Well, I suppose we've been conscious of this challenge ever since the arrival on the scene of or the prospect of minimum energy performance standards. And that's when the penny dropped with us, that we not doing anything was not an option. These buildings would not be lettable by now if we hadn't addressed them. So we've had a rolling program since then across the portfolio of improvement. Whenever we get space back, our aim is to improve the EPC rating by at least 2 grades and well above the current minimum standards, because the current minimum standards will change over time. They're going to become more challenging, more exacting. So it's all about future-proofing the portfolio, really. And we have done it gradually. We're probably about 80% of the way through. And the buildings, obviously listed buildings, are not included in this. And that's something we'll probably talk about later on. What's left to do are buildings that are still occupied under long leases. So we have an issue about getting back into those buildings. But it is doable. It's daunting at the outset, but we've learnt a lot along the way.
What are some of those key lessons that you've learnt along the way?
I think every building's different. It's got its own issues. Of course, some of this revolves around repurposing of space as well. Not every building is used in the same way throughout its life. And sometimes you can you change the character of the building by introducing new uses. But there, you know, one of the things we're thinking about very much now is, whilst we can do lots for our buildings, we need to help our tenants use our buildings more sustainably. And I guess we're going to talk about that later on. So as a landlord, you can't be hands off. And it's about as much about what our tenants do as what we do.
I think we'll definitely come back to the involvement there needs to be from occupiers and everyone, I guess, in this process. Karen, really keen to hear from you whether you have the sort of same experiences across Workspace Group.
Yeah, so for the MEES legislation, we definitely had to review our whole portfolio, and we looked at, we reassessed every single building, and then where we were falling below an E, the minimum standard, then we, as soon as the customers moved out, we then went in, upgraded the lighting, the insulation, and pushed the EPC as far up as possible. And then I do think that's sort of, it definitely has sort of accelerated some of the works that we've done. So at Park Hall down in Dulwich, we insulated the whole of the roof of one of the buildings there to bring that above the MEES legislation.
And aside from being driven by legislation and not being able to lease space if it's not up to standards, there must be sort of other benefits of retrofitting buildings that you know go beyond just that legislation. Does it make the building more attractive now to occupiers? Do you feel better about yourself for having buildings that are hopefully one day net positive?
Well, I think really the reality is that tenants are alive to this as much as landlords, and the expectation of tenants is changing all the time. If you've got a landlord that doesn't appear to care about these things, that won't get you a tick in the box if somebody's looking at your space, and actually the space itself. So I think tenants are looking for that sort of commitment. And I say, in a way, the way these buildings impact the environment, it's becoming a bit of a partnership, really. We can only do so much. We want them to be signed up to this and work alongside us. And I think a lot of businesses are getting that. We have obviously a lot of smaller tenants, and I think our job is to help them. They want to do the right thing. They don't have a big sustainability department to back them up and help them, but I think our job is to guide them in the right direction.
Yeah, same. So our customers and our investors are asking a lot more questions, especially over this last year or two. And then I think it's about giving the customers then the information that they need, so things like we're procuring 100% green electricity, and so that's reassuring for them, and also giving them the tools to be able to see how much energy they're using within their unit, so having smart sub-metering systems and portals for them to be able to see online how much energy they're using.
So can we talk a little around practically what we do to buildings to retrofit them? James?
Sure. You've got options, I guess. How ambitious are you?
How ambitious should people be, I suppose? What's the bare minimum and where should we really aim for?
Yeah, I mean, I guess your small works, if you're going to have as minimal an impact in terms of the day-to-day functionality of a retrofit, is in the building systems. There are huge advancements that I think they're likely to come forward with, simple things like lighting systems that within workplace environment can dictate and dominate a vast majority or significant portion of the energy consumption and therefore the carbon emissions. So they're also relatively easy to implement as changes. One step back, and Sarah touched on it, it was simply the management of those buildings, utilising the controls as they could be utilised, and responding to the way that the buildings are functioning in touch with the users. It's definitely going to be a combination of user behaviour plus advancements in technology and technique. I mean, you can scale it all the way back up and not far from where we are here. The old Stock Exchange building was completely taken back to the structure and then recast again, because the other aspect in the world of net zero is the embodied implications of your fit out, and even simply replacing your light fittings is embodied energy, embodied carbon. So I think there's a broadening of the horizon in that context, and considering those aspects.
I mean, it sounds like there's a lot to think about, and it can quite complicated. Chris, when you were advising clients, what are the kind of questions that they're answering, and how are you able to answer those questions?
Yeah, it does depend on aspiration, I feel. I think a lot is down to future resilience, some of what we've talked about, and resilience covers an awful lot of things. It was interesting last year during the summer, there were certain buildings that closed down because the chillers couldn't cope with the heat. If that's going to become more frequent, both for heat and cold, retrofit should be thinking about those things, as well as just what the occupiers think. I think technology is changing rapidly, and the health and well-being of a building should be part of the retrofit as well now. It shouldn't just be the energy efficiency. And yeah, James made a good point on the embodied carbon. It's a real focus for net zero, is usually energy efficiency, and that does start off with saying, can we make the building operate more efficiently with what we've got? And then how would we retrofit and change out what's there? Often we think about the heating ventilation systems, but actually the fabrication of the building is fundamental. But when you think of changing out the fabric of a building, that has a massive impact on embodied carbon. And when the type of insulation you use, or the glass, that can also have a big implication. So you could choose certain types which are incredibly energy efficient, but have a much bigger impact on embodied carbon. So you could work yourself against achieving your net zero by becoming more energy efficient in the building. And I think a lot of this actually needs real collaboration now between the architects, structural engineers, MEP consultants. All these players need to come together and really think about what is it we're trying to achieve for the client when we do a retrofit. What does that mean, and what is the end outcomes that looks which you know are successful?
Sarah, how do we bring those people together?
I think in our fragmented industry, that's an incredibly challenging thing to do. But I think one of the things that the whole kind of movement around net zero has enabled organisations and stakeholders to do is actually to coalesce around that as a goal. So I think one of the things that can bring all those parties together is having a shared outcome, and that outcome should be based on performance and the performance in use of the asset. And, you know, it's really important that those shared goals are then translated into the practical mechanisms within our industry that make those things happen. Because whilst as we as kind of leaders within the various businesses and sustainability professionals can be passionate about that, if you don't have your leasing team on board, if you haven't actually written those things into the contract for your contractors, for your facilities management, for your property managers, then it isn't going to work. So I think one of the things is to coalesce everybody around that shared goal and then make sure it's integrated into all of those different aspects that make or enable us to deliver buildings.
It's a big ask, isn't it? A really big ask. And I guess this industry hasn't in the past been that great at collaborating. It's getting much better, I think. But it's a big challenge to react to an even bigger challenge, I suppose.
It is. In some respects, we could look to another industry as a measure of how much you can achieve in a short space of time, and very much related to retrofit in the built environment. So in the UK, the energy market, from an electrical perspective, has managed to really accelerate its decarbonisation of the electricity grid. And it's doing its bit. I mean, it's really on a mission to achieve what it can do. Retrofit can really benefit from that, where you've got the constraints of an existing building, but if you can adapt to utilise a decarbonising electricity supply, that in itself is a kind of a resilience future proofing of it. I mean, that comes with the challenges of the infrastructure not being available, but I think there's an indication where things of significant, I guess, like acceleration can be achieved. It's a little bit more disparate within the construction industry, hence the key point about the coalescing, I think. It is very important.
So one way, I suppose, to get an entire industry on board is to talk about the value of retrofitting. What's it worth to, what's the point of doing it, I suppose? So I'd love to chat a little bit about cost versus value, because I imagine it's not cheap to retrofit a building, but there has to be some value to come with that. So Brian and Karen, keen to hear from you on cost versus value.
Well, buildings always need money spending on them. They do wear out, regardless whether you want to improve them at the same time. So you can do things when you can and think long term, not think like the cheapest short term option, perhaps. Try and think long term. It's quite challenging because nobody quite knows what the future is. But the reality is, in all of this, is you are faced with a building. The value destruction of a building that is not lettable, is not appealing to tenants. That's what you've got to think about, really. And so you've just got to face up to it, really. That's the way the world's changing. And you know, we have a minimum standards of energy performance. Unfortunately, they're not enforced in the way that they should be. Responsible owners will think about them, but there's an awful lot of people there who don't think about them. So actually, there needs to be more enforcement. There's no point having more regulation without that. And I think that will force people to think more and more. But I'm sure, like Workspace, you know, we get more and more questions from lenders and equity investors, because, you know, if you don't face up to this, you're going to be faced with loss of value or destruction of value completely.
Yeah, definitely. And I think lots of customers really like the combination of the old and the new together. Mm. So they like the history of the building. They like being in that space and the character. But they also want to be cool in the summer, warm in the winter, and they like the exposed brickwork. You know, it's about sort of meeting in the middle, really. So, and making sure that they're comfortable in terms of their temperature and things, and so getting to that point where actually customers are happy, and also the building is working in a very efficient way.
I think in a beautiful city like London, we are blessed, aren't we, with some fantastic old buildings, and we have to protect them. And you mentioned earlier listed buildings, Brian, and that they're outside of MEES, but we do need to do something about those, don't we? So what's the solution with listed buildings?
Well, I think it's getting politicians to think about the problem and put it on the agenda. Politicians are slightly obsessed, I always think, with shiny new buildings, and they don't think about all the building stock that's there already. And yes, we do want to preserve the character in these old buildings. They are part of what makes all of our cities so special. But we've got to be realistic. We can't have everything. We're going to have to make some compromises here along the way. As much as you were talking about your office occupiers wanting to be, you know, cool in the summer and warm in the winter, well, we can't. If we're going to really face up to this challenge big scale, we've all got to accept we may have to be a little warmer in the summer and perhaps a little cooler in the winter. But if we all do that, if we all accept that, that's the way we're all going to move forward. But I do think when, certainly for local authorities, those who enforce the current regulations, they've got to be a bit pragmatic about all this. And you see it more on the continent where older buildings can be sympathetically improved, but you can see that they've got proper double glazing in and some of the other issues are addressed. It's not the end of the world.
I think one of the challenges that we've had here that many of our BBP members have faced with heritage assets is the primary kind of driver in terms of regulatory or legislative intervention at the moment is energy performance certificates. And one of the real challenges with heritage buildings is that quite often that's quite a blunt instrument. You know, as in the case of Shaftesbury and Workspace, you need to treat every single building in its own way. And quite often the tools that we're using, like energy performance certificates, come out with recommendations that don't work for those particular buildings. So I think we need to get a little bit more sophisticated about that. And if instead we had instruments that were based on performance outcomes, there's no reason why heritage buildings can't improve their performance, but they just might not do it in the same way as a non-heritage building, if you like. So I think it's really important for us to become a little bit more sophisticated about those tools and have them based on performance outcomes.
Chris?
Yeah, I'd completely agree. I think the linkage of MEES to EPCs is a very blunt instrument, as we all agree. It looks at the theoretical rating of a building, which doesn't look at performance at all. And when we're trying to drive towards a very climate-driven planet and look at net zero, which links to that, EPCs are pretty weak. I think also certainty is so important, and at the moment so lack of certainty. And when you think of the life cycle of a building and when retrofits can be done with the major refurbishments, you know, between now and 2050, there may only be two cycles coming up, major cycles. And you know, I think landlords are really looking for certainty. Sure, we can use common sense as to what a tenant may want in a building, but legislation is going to be key to kind of drive what dictates is going to be important. And if it's moving toward net zero, we need to move away from MEES.
James?
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look at maybe trends outside of London and outside the UK, at the turn of the year, New York introduced Local Law 97, which is basically mandating a reduction of the largest buildings within Manhattan and New York of 40% by 2030, then 80% by 2050, but coming with that are financial penalties. So anecdotally, they're indicating that it could be up to $1 million a year in terms of financial penalties, and it's, again, relating to what Sarah was talking about, actual performance rather than certified processes. So those instruments plus a sophistication of how it's measured could be ways of incentivizing that value proposition, I guess.
It's definitely a motivator, isn't it?
And indeed, we know that the government is going to be consulting this year on the introduction of mandatory in-use performance for commercial buildings, so we need to watch that space carefully.
I'm really keen to look at, as you mentioned, Chris, the life cycle of buildings, and that we might only have an opportunity to retrofit once or twice before we get to 2050. Do we need to look at a way that we can retrofit while tenants are in place? Do we need to find ways that we can continually sort of bring a building up to standard? Or is that an impossibility?
That's a challenge. I think it really depends on the type of building and the landlord's influence over that building. There's an awful lot of buildings which are working on single lets, on FRI leases, and the influence of the landlord then is incredibly limited. Collaboration clearly with the occupiers is key. We've been talking for years now. I remember when I was at DTZ heading up property management, going back 15 years, we were talking about through real service that the tenant is a customer and we should love them. until we bailiff them, of course. but, you know, that whole collaboration, we talked about the collaboration piece. It is only actually through really good collaboration we're going to make a difference here. And I think the collaboration with the tenants is going to be fundamental. And that's not just in having open communication. I think it's finding financial structures which can benefit both the landlord and the tenant to make this work. And I think there's going to be, we're going to need some sort of green financial structures actually in place, which motivates both sides to make this happen.
Sure. Brian, you're nodding along there.
No, I absolutely agree, but I think we're pushing at an open door now. Tenants do want to get involved. You've got a side issue that, you know, leases are getting shorter. Tenants don't see themselves being in buildings for as long as they used to be. But wherever they go, it's going to be an issue. And it's about behaviours, really, and some simple things you can do around your own office. And we all look around to see the things we could do. But again, it comes back to informing people, telling them what their options are, what they can do. And I'd like to think most people are going to start buying into that now.
I think there are two things sort of in response to that. Is first of all, is there is a changing relationship between landlord and tenant, which actually has some really quite interesting opportunities, but also challenges in terms of sustainability and indeed the market. You know, the shorter leases, the more flexible leases, means that actually the landlord may need to take control of the building in a way that it hasn't done previously, certainly in certain sectors. And I think that's going to be a really interesting change in the market that might actually help in terms of that closer landlord occupier engagement. And the second thing is just quite specific on kind of intervening in that relationship. I think we can get carried away by thinking about large refurbishments and all the things that we do. Quite a lot of the things that we need to do to improve our existing buildings can actually be relatively small interventions, upgrades in lighting, actually just getting the building management system to work, commissioning it correctly, getting people to manage the buildings well, making sure they understand how the building works. These don't necessarily have to be huge interventions in order to improve the efficiency of those assets.
Do you think people will get overwhelmed then when they hear the word retrofitting, and they think that means I've got to strip this whole building out and build a new one without building a new one?
I think it does. I think it does come down to definition and how we vocalise these things. You know, I think we've all said around the table that there's an immediate opportunity where we can just make the performance of buildings far greater by aligning the way the building operates to what the occupiers need. You'll never get a perfect fit. The sort of thermal comfort for one occupier is going to be very different to another. That's always going to be the way. So,
it's very much the way in the Shaftesbury office. Yeah. I can tell you, the arguments over the open window just never end.
I do think it's how we vocalise this. But, you know, when we talk about sort of retrofit, I think immediately you do think about major refurb. But when you look at the majority of buildings out there, they are not designed for performance based on what's in them at the moment. And, you know, when you go back to net zero, the first thing, if you kind of look at the pyramid of what to do, the first thing is just to make it efficient for the occupiers and how as it operates. And that's, you know, we're doing a lot of that, but even for what we're doing, it's an incredibly small percentage of what's out there.
Yeah, if you took the analogy maybe of your iPhone or similar, where you get background software updates, you wonder whether...
They always ruin the operation of the phone.
Well, yeah. To slow down the building.
Yeah. Make you buy a new one.
Yeah. But if you have the solid functional backbone, but the building could learn how it's being used and then update its operation. I mean, this isn't necessarily something that would happen tomorrow, but we've got a real agenda and we've got a limited amount of time. So ambition needs to be there. But that could be a layer of background updating where we really are refining the operation of buildings based on what's in them. Then you get into the layers of intervention. But it feels like there's scope for technology to help in that space.
And that requires landlords, I suppose, to be maybe smarter than they used to be.
Yeah, definitely. I think where we've put our smart sub-metering systems, that allows the facilities manager to control and manage that building remotely from wherever they are, and they can adjust the controls. And then, again, for our customers then to actually be able to log on and see their consumption on the computer in front of them.
I often bang on about the real estate industry and its need to attract talent. And I always think that when we have conversations like this and we talk about what property owners, developers, engineers, anyone involved in this sector needs to do, it sounds fascinating to me and something that requires intelligence and problem solving and should be a real draw to get people into this sector. Is that something, Brian, that you talk about at Shaftesbury when you're looking for new talent, all of these opportunities that there are in the problems that we can and need to solve?
Well, you certainly need a whole different range of skill sets in running a property company than you would have done 5, certainly 10 years ago. Maybe it's very different now, 5 years, and it'll be more so in the future. So I do think that, you know, the mix of people, not just from a surveying background, is very useful in some of these conversations. I think, being rude about the industry, it's a bit rooted in its past and traditions, but actually bringing people who haven't gone through that sort of learning process, and particularly younger people who are so aware of these issues that we've all got to face up to very quickly, I think that's bringing a momentum to it. And as I say, behind it all, us old dinosaurs are conscious of the fact that, you know, unlettable buildings have no value, so we need to get on and address this one way or another. Sooner or later, if we don't, it'll come back to haunt us.
I do think we have a perception issue in terms of our industry and how attractive we can make that to those with talent that we want to bring across in that diverse range and that diverse pool of talent that's out there. And I definitely think that both sustainability and technology are issues that are really attractive to those coming into the industry, and what we need to do is work hard as an industry to make this an attractive industry to work in. You know, we often say about buildings it's not rocket science in terms of improving their sustainability, but rocket science sounds much more attractive than building service engineer.
Well, let's get all the rocket scientists into real estate. I guess just to round us up, I'm going to stop calling it retrofitting, and I think we should talk about efficiency improvement, perhaps, instead of retrofitting. And I guess that is something that continues throughout the life cycle of a building. So with that in mind, I'd love a quick sort of one thing that everyone who's listening to this podcast could do either within their business or within their building to improve the efficiency of it. I'm going to start with you, Karen. Sorry.
I think it's an education piece. I think behaviour change is a huge thing, especially us as landlords. You know, we have control of a certain, you know, the main plant and that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, it's the customers who are using the majority of the building's energy. We can see on our half-hourly profiles of the electricity meters that, you know, lights are being left on, like energy is being used overnight and at the weekends when nobody's in the building. So I think education and communication.
Fantastic. Thank you. Sarah?
Yeah, it's going to sound like a bit of a broken record now, but my one thing to do would be just for everybody in the supply chain in our industry to manage those buildings for performance, full stop.
Fantastic. Thank you. Chris?
Sarah's taken mine. And I think what you said, Sam, about efficiency, I think if I was going to change that slightly, I'd say let's drive performance and just keep at that. I think, yeah, there's marginal gains here. We don't have to try and do everything overnight, which scares people. So I think it's trying to find those marginal gains, and whether that's engaging with the occupier or it's just making the BMS, but it's regularly looked at and set up so that it works well for the occupiers and drives efficiency.
Marginal gains worked very well for the British Cycling team, so I think that's okay. Brian?
Yes, there are no magic bullets to any of this, and if we, you know, think seriously about it, it's future-proofing, really, future-proofing businesses and buildings. It's about behaviours and mindsets, really. And if there's one thing I would ask all of our shops and restaurants to do, it's close the door. The thing that really winds me up is you walk past shops and restaurants. In the summer, they're blasting out cold air because they won't close the door. In the winter, they're blasting out the heat. Little things like that. People will still walk in if the door's closed. But you talk to a retailer, restaurateur, oh, no. So anyway, we've got a long way to go, but it is these smaller things will make a big difference if we all start to buy into it and insist on it.
shut the front door, I think, is the phrase, isn't it? Brilliant. Thank you, James.
Okay, going last. So four of my suggestions have all gone. I think picking up on something I was touched on earlier, if the relationship between landlord and tenant became something productively more competitive in some way, I suppose, with the tenants coming forward to say, actually, as landlords, we need you to do more, and then also the landlords coming forward to say, look, we can help you go further. I think that kind of stimulation in terms of a relationship there, you can then get into the detail of how to do that. But stimulating it that way, I think, would be a productive way forward.
Fantastic. So collaboration, education, a decent management system, simple things like shutting the front door and maybe putting a jumper on if it's a bit cold, or just wearing a t-shirt if it's too hot, are the things that we can do to improve performance, and we don't necessarily need to rip out lots of a building to make it be better. I think there's so much more that we can delve into in this podcast, but we will save those for another day, another episode. There will be lots more to come. But for the time being, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you.